very special father, special guest here this morning with us, Thomas Burr, Communications Manager of NAMI, Connecticut, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Dan met him at a ball game. And this is something that I don't think a lot of folks realize is a huge problem in the United States of America. Thomas, again, for those who are just joining us, how many are in this mental health situation?
Well, Brad, it's about one in five families here in the U.S. that are dealing with this. It's just a huge problem.
Thomas Burr is in our Touchpoints Rehab Interview Chair, along with Daniela Giordano, Public Policy Director of NAMI. Tommy, you were talking about your son, John, and it had gotten to the point where he had reached the end of the line, so to speak. So what turned it around for him?
Well, you know, for his situation, it was really the last time he was in the hospital. He was bipolar, which, if you know anything about bipolar disorder, it's periods of mania where people are literally psychotic and just not thinking clearly at all, hallucinating and hearing voices and just not in a really good place at all. But other times it's suicidal depression. And the last time he was in the hospital, it was when he was depressed to the point of considering suicide. But he realized it, and he, you know, admitted himself into the hospital. The good news is that he was lucid. He wasn't manic. He was lucid. He was just very, very depressed. And while we were visiting him, his mother and I were visiting him in the hospital, and this was the Institute of Living here in Hartford that does a wonderful job, we were talking to him. And while we were talking to him, this young lady walked by who looked like she very well could have been in the throes of the manic phase of bipolar. You know, she was talking to things that weren't there and just acting very strangely. And she walked by, and after she was out of earshot, John turns to his mother and I and says, "Is that how I am when I'm manic?" And we said, "Yeah." He said, "I don't ever want to be like that again." And that was his turning point.
Wow.
And from that point on, he started to really meaningfully work on his recovery, you know.
Himself.
Yes.
Well, how?
Everyone has to do it by themselves.
Right.
No one can force somebody else to recover. In fact, if you try to force the issue, you end up alienating the person. And that's one of the things you learn at the classes that we hold, is that, you know, there's ways to approach people that are productive and ways to approach people that are very counterproductive. And you can't force somebody to take medicine or go to therapy. You know, you have to want the person has to want to do it. And that's what Daniela was talking about earlier, is, you know, engage the person, find out what motivates them and work with that.
Okay. So he reaches this epiphany, and so he decides he's going to turn his life around.
Yes.
But what programs are out there to help him turn his life around?
Well, you know, he was at this point in the state system, and the state of Connecticut has various programs. At one point, he was up at the Capital Region's facility in the north end of Hartford, which was also a wonderful facility. And they help people, you know, get established with housing. They have potentially programs to help with employment, supportive employment. In fact, it's interesting. For many years, it was thought that employment was too much for someone who was dealing with a serious mental health challenge to be expected of them, that it was too stressful and that they shouldn't work. We've done a 180 on that. We actually found that, you know, having someone who has a meaningful job is a great therapy. It gives them meaningful work. It produces, you know, feelings of, you know, actually contributing to society. And, you know, any program like the state runs through Bureau of Rehabilitation Services and that kind of thing that can provide supported employment is wonderful, because it really does help people kind of work their way through their recovery.
Now, how long did it take him to get where he is now, and how old is he now?
He just turned 36 in May, last month, and it took him 8 years.
8 years.
Yeah, and that's actually a little above average. The average turnaround for someone is typically 2 to 5 years, which is a long time if you're in crisis.
Sure, it's a long time.
Yeah.
And, Daniela, these programs, all of these programs would be jeopardized under the budget proposals being put forth?
Yes, so they are. And this is Daniela again. And actually, Tom was mentioning it a little bit a couple times. The one thing that we haven't talked about in terms of the importance of it is housing. So we in Connecticut are leaders in a lot of areas, including in preventing and ending homelessness. And we've had some successes. There is a campaign, Reaching Home, out there that really has been a collaborative effort between advocates, providers of housing, social service providers, and also government and agencies on the state and the federal level in order to really put a system in place for people to be able to be connected to things that actually housing models that work for them. Supportive housing is really one of the biggest ones for individuals who may be dealing with some more complex, challenging mental health and substance use conditions, and it provides the housing piece, also rental vouchers, as well as the connected services that are being determined by the individual of what they want, whether that's, for example, what Tom mentioned, employment.
Well, have they told you definitely that this is gone, or is this just talk?
No, it's not at all gone. Actually, housing has been something that the current administration in Connecticut has been very supportive of and a leader on, and the legislature as well. But because the budget deficit is so stark, that there has been some proposals out there that are proposing to reduce the support services and some of the housing vouchers for Connecticut residents that rely on those in order to really bring their lives back on track. And nothing is said and done yet. We don't have, as you know, we don't have a state budget yet, even though we're supposed to have one a couple of weeks ago. The next deadline, in a way, is the end of this month.
Right.
Our new fiscal year starts on July 1st, making things worse if you don't have a budget.
Daniela, if some of these programs were cut, would people be thrown out on the streets?
They're absolutely, in terms of people not having, for example, if somebody loses their housing voucher and won't be able to pay for their housing, there absolutely would be more people at risk of losing their housing, and people who are currently homeless not being able to be matched to housing resources, or people, like I said earlier, who may rely on legal services if they're having some trouble with a landlord, that the legal services that are being proposed to be cut, those housing advocacy services would be lost, and people would absolutely be at much higher risk of losing housing and therefore costing the state also a lot more beyond the human cost, obviously, of somebody not being able to live stably in the community.
So it could increase homelessness then. It could.
Absolutely.
Okay. Hold that thought there. Brad, I know you have another traffic update.
17 minutes.
Thomas Burr, Communications Manager of NAMI Connecticut, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Daniela Giordano, Public Policy Director of NAMI. Tom, how much, because we hear so much about the drug problem in this country, contributes to mental illness?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're still trying to get the exact stats down as far as how much there is the co-occurring disorders, people with both a mental health challenge as well as a substance abuse problem. I've seen a low of a number of 40% of people who have both. I've talked to literally mental health professionals, doctors and nurses who claim it's 100%, which I frankly don't believe, because I have met people in my travels with NAMI who have been in full recovery from a serious mental illness. And, you know, they tell me, I've never had a substance abuse problem. I was never drinking. I was never drugging. I've got no reason to doubt them. I believe they're telling me the truth. So it isn't 100%, but it's pretty significant. My gut tells me it's probably closer to 60, 70%.
Really?
People who self-medicate their underlying mental health condition with drugs or alcohol,
mm-hmm.
or both.
Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about NAMI, how NAMI can help, how it helped you, for example.
Well, I mentioned the support group. You know, my wife dragged me kicking and screaming to my first support group way back when my son was sick, because I'm a guy and we don't ask for directions, we don't ask for help. And it was a wonderful experience. You know, it was just a warm, very warm and open setting where people with lived experience, you know, who've been down this road, could give us some perspective. And it means so much to me even today. I still, as a volunteer with the Manchester affiliate of NAMI, we've got 11 affiliates scattered throughout the state. At the Manchester affiliate, I'm still a volunteer support group facilitator because it's a way for me to give back. And it just helped us out tremendously with understanding what we were dealing with. And then from there, we go into the education classes like Family to Family that give us the background information and the coping skills to understand what we're really dealing with and how to help our loved ones.
You know, what has affected me here just listening to you this morning, first of all, I never realized there were this many
everybody
in
knows
our
somebody,
population
Brad. Everybody
that,
knows
that are affected by this, and probably some don't know what's wrong.
Yeah, it's again, they don't necessarily teach this stuff in school. In fact, that's one of our initiatives right now, is to get this kind of education into the school systems. We have two different programs that we provide. One for teachers and staff called Parent and Teachers as Allies, where we come in and educate the teachers on what to look for and look out for. We're not turning them into clinicians. They're not going to diagnose anyone. But if they see a student who's struggling, they'll know what to look for. And most importantly, when they do see this, what to do. How do they connect the student to the services that they need so they can regain their health? And we also have a corresponding program called Ending the Silence, which is for the students, because let's face it, the friends of someone who's struggling know that they're struggling long before the parents or the teachers do. And this, again, we're not teaching them to diagnose anyone, but we're having the students understand what to look for, not to be ashamed of these things because they are so common, and, okay, your friend is struggling, what do you do? Who do you talk to? What, you know, who's a trusted adult that you can say something to so the person can get the help they need? You know, we talk about suicide, you know, what to look for, what to say, what not to say. And that's a 1 hour, you know, it fits into a class schedule. So a typical, like, health class, we come in, educate the students, and that way they can help their friends. Or if they themselves are struggling, they know that, hey, it's okay, this is common, and this is the help that I can expect.
What about symptoms? For example, what were some of the symptoms you noticed with your son?
Well, with John, you know, he started to have panic attacks, which I don't know if you've ever seen.
What is a panic attack for those that don't know?
Yeah, it's just, it blows your mind. It's like the person who's having a panic attack literally feels like they're dying. They're just, their body just kind of like freaks out on them. Their heart races. They think they're going to pass out and die, and they're just consumed with this just overwhelming fear. And it's just awful. And he started to have panic attacks, and we're like, what is all this? And, you know, we took him to the doctor, and the doctors really weren't sure what was going on. You know, when he started to exhibit some of the mood swings that are not at all uncommon with bipolar, you know, we took him to a psychologist. And, you know, this was the weird thing. And, again, because of the stigma, you know, John didn't want to admit that he was struggling. He would sit there in the psychologist's office like the perfect gentleman with his hands folded. And, you know, meanwhile, his mom's there and she's crying and I'm there and I'm all upset because of, you know, the struggles and what do we do. And John's sitting there like a perfect gentleman. And I think the psychologist thought that it was his mom and us that we had the problem. And eventually he said, well, you know, I think John's just a little depressed, so we're going to give him an antidepressant. Now, one of the things you learn in the family-to-family class is the worst thing you can do with someone with bipolar disorder is give them an antidepressant without a corresponding mood stabilizer, because what happens, and this is exactly what happened with John, it put him right into mania. He wound up in the hospital. He was completely psychotic. It was awful.
Wow. Now, you said that even though you had gone to NAMI, it still took you a while to come to understand what your son was enduring. Explain that.
Well, this is the thing. You know, I had the intellectual understanding from taking the classes and going to the support groups of what mental health and mental illness was all about. I understood what bipolar was. But there was still a part of me that was just kind of angry about this, which is typical. I mean, we go in the support groups, we talk about the different stages of your emotions, you know, how you go from denial to anger to acceptance and all that. It's, you know, like the hierarchy of needs. Anyway, I still didn't really understand it from an emotional level. And what finally got me to understand it was the day that I went to visit John. This was after we said you can't live at the house anymore. We had set him up in a single-room occupancy apartment over in Manchester. It was not a great place, but he wasn't homeless at least, you know, and we were doing this out of our own pocket. And I went to visit him because, you know, one of the things they teach in the class is you want to stay connected with your loved one. You don't want to just ostracize them. You want to stay connected. So I was going to take him out to dinner. I went up to his room. And it looked like someone had taken three large garbage cans of trash and just spread it on every flat surface in the room, on the bed, on the dresser, the TV stand, the floor. Everything was covered with trash. And that, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. It's like, you know, he's not faking this. He's not just being lazy. He's not being a bum. He's really sick because no one in their right mind would ever choose to live like this. And that's when I felt it in my heart. And that's when I had, you know, the compassion started to really flow for me because I said, you know, he's really sick and we've just got to get him the help that he needs.
Wow. Daniela, we have about 30 seconds left. Can you explain what you're hearing from lawmakers when you lobby them about this?
I think lawmakers have come a long way in terms of understanding that mental health and substance use is a really important topic. Because we don't always, even in our country, we don't talk about mental health, substance use, or even other health conditions. It's just part of overall health. We separate it out, and that's why we have all these separate entities for it and separate reimbursement rates and all that. But that it's really just part of overall well-being. And also the other fact really is, and when you were talking about before, you didn't realize how prevalent it is, that I would venture to say, just based on the statistics, that you know people in your circle of friends, in your family, your colleagues, your neighbors. People are dealing with mental health challenges, whether it's a diagnosed mental health condition or something that's maybe not as severe. But it's something that we all live in a continuum of health, and that includes mental health. And it's something that, therefore, we can all really just participate and really think of it as something that impacts all of us. And
Daniela, we're out of time. Well. Daniela, out of time. Great, great job. Thank you, Daniela, for joining us this morning. Tom, if someone wants to, you're welcome. If you want to get in touch, someone wants to get in touch with NAMI, how do they do that?
We have our website, which is NAMI CT. That's NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness CT for Connecticut, NAMICT.org, or they can call our warm line, which is 860-882-0236, and we'd be happy to talk to anyone who has any questions.
Again.
860-882-0236.
Out of time.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Unreal.